John does not mention at all the single most significant moment in King John's reign, which is the signing of the Magna Carta. It's not there at all. He never mentions it. This apparently is a true story, although it's so good I kind of doubted it. A busload of American tourists were traveling around historical sites in Britain and stopped at Runnymede. And two elderly ladies got back on the bus and said to the guy, "Now, why didn't he stop there?" And the guy said, "Well, that's where the Magna Carta was signed." And they said, "Oh, when was that?" He said, 1215. They said, "Oh, we missed it by..." But there's no mention of it at all in King John. But then, curiously, comes Richard II, the two parts of Henry IV, Henry V. He'll follow it at the very end of his career. I can talk about it later. It's not of great interest. After his retirement, he wrote some scenes of the play about Henry VIII, but it's not basically his work. It's mostly John Fletcher. Now, I'm going to talk to him about Richard II, and much to say about it, but one thing I want to do at the outset is establish this play as a crucial turning point in Shakespeare's career. We suspect the play was written sometime around 1594-1595. The reason this is important is that in that time frame, he wrote, and we don't know the order in which they were written, three of his greatest masterpieces: Romeo and Juliet, Richard II, and A Midsummer Night's Dream. And they came one after another, all within a very narrow space of time. The reason they're so significant is that if Shakespeare had died in 1593 or 1594, let's say 1593, the year that young Christopher Marlowe died at the age of 29, dead in the tavern brawl, the details of which are still unclear, I won't go into those now, but had Shakespeare died at that time, he would have been remembered as one of a school of very good playwrights, along with a whole group of other very good playwrights. Something happened in 1594-1595, and this talented young man suddenly became a genius. We can understand, in some senses, a Mozart who's a born genius, who at the age of 4 is writing his first violin sonata, and at the age of 7 writes his first symphony, and at the age of 11 writes his first opera. This is comprehensible. The genius was there, it was given by God, it was a unique gift. What is more puzzling is to see a good talent, a sincere, decent, working talent, that suddenly, out of nowhere, skyrockets into genius. Shakespeare's is the most extraordinary case. All we can say is that this very talented playwright suddenly was given an ability to use his gifts in a way that had been unimaginable before. And what we get in A Midsummer Night's Dream, one of his greatest comedies, Romeo and Juliet, you've heard of it, and Richard II, one of his very greatest history plays, is a talent that took off and never looked back. From that point on, he was simply one of the most extraordinary writers to have ever written. How did it happen? We don't know. Did it happen? Yes, because the fruits of it are there. What's very interesting is that what you have, a great comedy, a tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, and then a history play, but I'm going to make a strange claim. Richard II, I think, is his first great, remarkable tragedy, not Romeo and Juliet. The reason I say that is that up until that point, he had written three tragedies. First, a piece called Titus Andronicus, based on Roman legend, that is modeled on Seneca. T.S. Eliot calls it the worst play ever written by anyone, which is an exaggeration. But it's a very bloody and over-the-top stage vehicle where he was learning his oaths and giving the audience what they wanted, and what they wanted was a lot of blood, and he gave it to them. It's not one of his better plays. And it's not a place where he's really learning how to write tragedy. Romeo and Juliet, obviously, is a tragedy. But the basic structure of the play, a play written when he was turning out many of his greatest comedies, he had just done Comedy of Errors, Love's Labor's Lost, Taming of the Shrew, Two Gentlemen of Verona. So the comic structure is in his mind, if you will. And while it is obviously a very disturbing and heartbreaking and devastating story of failed love, I can talk about that later if we have the time, but the structure is comic. What I mean by that is the core of the drama is a social dilemma. It is social conflict between two families within the city. And what happens by the end of the play is a tremendous healing as the society comes back together, and indeed the two families join together for a greater good. That is comic structure. Now the price that's been paid are the two young people. But in a curious way, it's not quite traditional tragic structure that would impel Shakespeare forward to become one of the greatest tragedians to ever put pen to paper. We see that in Richard II. What does that mean? Well, the tragic structure in Richard II, the reason I call it his first great tragedy, is that we have a truly remarkable man, in many ways a great man, with a tremendous failure, a tragic flaw. In Richard's case, overweening pride. Because of his tragic flaw, he makes a tragic mistake, and in doing so, not only brings himself down, but brings down all of those around him as well. At the end of the play, not only has Richard fallen, but the England he leaves behind him after his fall is doomed to civil war for years to come. So it is not just a personal story of a personal failure. All great tragedy has enormous ramifications in which the fall of the tragic hero condemns the world in which the tragic hero has lived to an impossible situation. Think of the end of Julius Caesar, the end of Hamlet, the end of Othello, Lear, Macbeth. These worlds are in ruin, and people try to put them back together again. Richard has done that by the end of the play. But the other thing that we have in Richard II, and I'll speak about this at some length, in a great tragedy, the tragic hero who falls is gaining in tragic knowledge. And in some ways, in human terms, is better off for having fallen than he was at the beginning of the play before that disaster took place. Richard becomes a genuinely tragic figure in that he learns about himself, his world, and what it is that's inside him and what it means to be a man, things he did not know beforehand. And as a result, I call him a genuine tragic figure. We'll look at how that works. So, the work seems to be a tragedy. Shakespeare's first truly great tragedy. Richard III's good, but it's imitation Marlowe. He simply, again, was learning from a master and imitates Marlowe throughout Richard III. He's a good imitator. It's a great play. But Richard II is very much his own. Now, if Richard II is a tragedy, the rest of that tetralogy follows a very curious path. We move from Richard II, which is a tragedy, to Henry IV, Part 1, which can only, I think, be called a historical, comic, semi-tragedy. It's a very unusually structured play, absolutely unique, one of his greatest. We move to Henry IV, Part 2, which I'm going to discuss tomorrow. I view the play as an elegy, a farewell to a time and a place, a bidding adieu to a dying world. It's a very unusual play. And then Henry V, that rounds out the sequence, is the closest any dramatist has ever come to writing an epic. Epics are usually in verse. Shakespeare knew he wasn't writing an epic, but there are touches of the epic in Henry V. So what we get in this tetralogy is four very different kinds of play. The only thing I know like it is what Wagner did with his Ring cycle. lucky enough to study The Ring many years ago with a great American composer named Dominic Argento. And Argento made the point that actually Wagner's Ring cycle is like a gigantic symphony in four movements. That the first, Das Rheingold, being the first movement in which all the themes are presented, the second, Die Walküre, being an andante, the third, Siegfried, being a scherzo, and then the final movement, which is Götterdämmerung. Very unusual. But Wagner's impulse in that massive tetralogy, in some ways similar to Shakespeare's. No two of the works in the great work, in the large work, are exactly the same. Now here's an oddity. Richard II opens, as I said, near the end of Richard's reign. He became king in 1377. He was the grandson of Edward III. His father, Edward the Black Prince, who was a very fine warrior, had been killed in France. Richard was only 10 years old when he came to the throne, a very young man. He had very powerful uncles who surrounded him and who basically ruled the land while the young boy may have been wearing the crown. And for many years, there were tensions and troubles among the uncles, the most powerful being John of Gaunt and Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester. The Duke of York had some influence as well, but as he's presented by Shakespeare and Richard II, a much weaker figure and vacillating constantly. Throughout Richard II, he's moving from one side to another side and never wants to really make waves anywhere. Anyway, he's one of those people who wants to compromise and be on the winning side, whoever that might happen to be. But the tensions between John of Gaunt and Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, and then between the king himself as he began to grow up, and come to the point where he wanted to rule, and no longer cared to have his uncles and other advisors do the ruling, came to a head when Richard decided he had to get rid of his uncle Gloucester. And indeed, this cannot be proven, but historians say it is very likely the case, commanded that his uncle be put to death, so that Thomas Mowbray, who appears in the very first scene of the play, the Duke of Norfolk, follows the command of the king and murders Richard's uncle, Humphrey Duke. It was known that this had happened, and John of Gaunt's son, known as Henry Bolingbroke through these plays, publicly accused Mowbray of being a traitor to the realm, i.e., having killed one of the leading figures in the royal household. Richard II opens in the first act with these two men confronting each other. I find it fascinating that nowhere in Act One does Shakespeare need to tell his audience the history of what went on. He assumes that the audience at the theater seeing this would have known that history. They would have been aware of that background. This would be nearly 200 years after the events. But it suggests something about the nature of the knowledge of history back then, and that these things were passed down, were known. Nowhere does he make it clear, or need to tell his audience, what the background is. So then, the son of John of Gaunt, Henry Bolingbroke, confronts Thomas Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, and basically, the argument is this: you killed one of the members of the royal family. Now here is Richard's dilemma. He ordered it. If he supports Henry Bolingbroke in the challenge to Mowbray, he's basically saying, no one can do my work and be trusted ever again. Be trusted that I will protect and guard them. Because everyone who Richard had given the order, Mowbray had carried it out, and now he's going to back away from him. At which point, who's ever going to follow another order? At the same time, if he supports Thomas Mowbray against the claim of Henry Bolingbroke, who is saying, you cannot go around murdering members of the royal family, And Richard says, well, I guess you can. He's leaving himself and the rest of the royal family open to a free-for-all. I guess it's open season. And you can kill whoever you want to as long as you can get away with it. He has no way out. He has no way out. The two gentlemen challenge each other. It's a wonderful scene. They take off their gauntlets. They throw them down. It's very dramatic. And Richard says, well, all right. If you won't listen to me and I can't smooth it over, then we'll have the public opposition meet on such and such a day. You two can challenge each other. And my God, this up. In Act 1, Scene 3, very formal ceremony. Formal charges are made once again. The two men go to mount their horses. They're about to ride at each other with their lances and may the right prevail. Whoever wins, Richard loses. And right at the moment that the contest is about to begin, Richard throws his gauge down and stops it and banishes both of them. You've got a real problem. What you do is you banish them. Just get rid of it. He banishes Bowbury for life. He banishes Harry Bolingbroke for 10 years and says to himself, problem taken clear, taken care of. Now, obviously, you know, things don't work that way. And then, having proven himself totally wishy-washy and self-serving, in the last scene of the first act, we see him with his royal favorites, and they're partying and having a good time, which is much of what he's doing in the court, at the same time bankrupting England. And he learns that he has to go off and fight a rebellion in Ireland. He doesn't have the money to do it. And fortunately, word comes that Henry Bolingbroke's father, old John of Gaunt, is grievous sick, my lord, suddenly taken, and hath sent post-haste to entreat your majesty to visit him. Where lies he? At Ely House. Now putteth God in the physician's mind to help him to his grave immediately. The lining of his coffers shall make coats to deck our soldiers for these Irish wars. Come, gentlemen, let's go visit him. Pray God we may make haste and come too late. Holy Callis, this is his own uncle, and one of the most dominating figures in the realm. A chance to get some money. Now, Act 2, Scene 1 contains that great, great speech you all know. Every English school child has had to learn it. It is, if you will, almost, if one had to point to one passage of poetry that Englishmen look to with pride, it would have to be this description of that wonderful island in which you live, and it's old John of Gaunt, as he's dying, who reflects upon this kingdom he's about to leave. Forgive me for reading it to you. You know it better than I do, probably. But I'm going to point out something about this speech. This royal throne of kings, this sceptered isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden, demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall, or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, this nurse, this teeming womb of royal kings, feared by their breed and famous by their birth, renowned for their deeds as far from home, for Christian service and true chivalry, as is the sepulchre in stubborn Jewry of the world's ransom, Blessed Mary's Son. This land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation through the world, all of that is the subject of a sentence. We now come to the predicate of the sentence. Is now least out. I die pronouncing it, like to a tenement or peasant farm. England bound me with the triumphant sea, whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune, is now bound in with shame, with inky blots and rotten parchment bonds. paper currency. That England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself. Ah, would the scandal vanish with my life, how happy then were my ensuing death and Richard comes in. Notion is, indeed, the king is bankrupt of the country. And what he has done is simply created, and this is the way many a good nation falls, phony paper to drain the people dry. And then pocket the money for personal costs. For personal costs. Now, it's a privilege of the dying, and old John of Gaunt turns on his nephew and gives him what for. Tells him exactly what he thinks, and Shakespeare at his dramatic best. The king, the nephew, who is indeed a deeply flawed character, and the old dying man who is finally opening his mouth and unleashing on his nephew, who is indeed the king, and gives him what for, to the point where Richard cuts him off and says, a lunatic, weak-witted fool, presuming on an Agnew's privilege, and starts handing it back to the old man. Gaunt doesn't stop, finally exhausts himself in his attack on his nephew and has to be taken out of the room, and word comes almost instantaneously that he has died. Richard, in his monumental pride, decrees that he is seizing the entire inheritance of John of Gaunt and taking it for his own uses. Having banished the son, who's the rightful heir, Richard now seizes all the estates, all the lands, and indeed gives the order that from that point on, he will simply have blank charters going out, and money can be raised simply by going around to the nobility and having them sign off on it, and then the actual amount will be filled in later depending on what's outrageous. He has alienated the nobility. He has alienated those around him. He has bankrupted the country. He has insulted his uncle, the second greatest man in the realm, at the moment the old man is dying. He's been told to his face what he's been up to. He's been given, if you will, a serious corrective, and he's ignoring it. How can we call this man great? Well, we call him great because he has an incredible capacity to take possession of any place he is and turn the attention to himself and become a self-dramatist with the language and the imagination to create an endless series of scenes around himself that is simply exquisite. It is a kind of genius. It is a kind of greatness. It's not necessarily what you want in any king or public figure, but there's no denying the fact that there is something in Richard that sets him apart, that makes him different from other men, absolutely unique. It's a rare gift, and it has to be balanced with his tremendous pride and his ability to make absolutely foolish, destructive, spontaneous decisions. He's both of these. What Shakespeare is creating in his hero is a real human being, a gigantic human being with extraordinary gifts and extraordinary fallibilities. I.e., he's human. He's human. Now, he goes off to fight the Irish. And of course, as soon as he's gone, and word has reached young Henry Bolingbroke that his inheritance has been seized by the king, Bolingbroke comes back from France and begins marching through England to confront the king. And as he marches through England, the populace, having become fed up with Richard, cheer and begin joining with him. We all of a sudden have the very popular political hero. It happens over and over and over. And the people don't care that much about the initial problem that allowed him to come back. What they want is somebody to get rid of the king that they don't like. Simply popular politics. And they don't like Richard. And here comes a knight in shining armor riding across the land to confront the evil king, and they're all cheering him, and it's wonderful, and they don't know the man. They don't know what he's about. They don't know what he's going to do. This sounds very like an election. It happens over and over and over again. Now, Henry Bolingbroke does not have the complexity of Richard II. He's a practical, down-to-earth politician. He's a wronged man, no doubt about it. He's coming to get his own, which he deserves. It was taken away from him. But he's also Machiavellian. He's very clever, very clever. And all of a sudden he realizes he has a swell of public support behind him. And as he marches across the kingdom, getting ready to meet Richard when Richard returns from Ireland, the central conflict of the play is unavoidable. We have these two men, and they're going to meet. Now, Richard comes back from Ireland and arrives in Wales near Berkeley Castle. And word comes to him that Bolingbroke is on the move. And Richard, being totally self-absorbed, doesn't worry about it at all. Indeed, he says, well, when the sun, the searching eye of heaven, is hid behind the globe and lights the lower world, then thieves and robbers rage abroad unseen in murders and in outrage boldly here. But when from under this terrestrial wall he fires the proud tops of eastern pines and darts his light through every guilty hole, then murders, treasons, and detested sins, the cloak of night being plucked from off their backs, stand bare and naked, trembling at themselves. So when this thief, this traitor, Bolingbroke, who all this while hath reveled in the night whilst we were wandering with the Antipodes, shall see us rising in our throne, the East, his treasons will sit blushing in his face, not able to endure the sight of day. He's comparing himself to the sun. Well, of course this happened because I was abroad. But now, like the sun rising up in the morning, here I am, and that will be the end of it. Well, he's totally foolish. He has no self-knowledge, but the language is magnificent. And the self-dramatization is so excessive, we're drawn to it, especially when we hear Bolingbroke just talking plain, dull, political speech. And indeed, Richard continues in this way, to the point he is the anointed king. For every man that Bolingbroke hath pressed to lift shrewd steel against our golden crown, God for his Richard hath in heavenly pay a glorious angel. Then if angels fight, weak men must fall, for heaven still guards the right. Now he's not only the son, but he's got God on his side, and all the angels will come in his defense. The man is crazy. The man is crazy. He is saying, by my position alone, by my position alone, I will be fine, and I don't have to worry. Whereupon word comes to him that his own have begun to abandon him, one after another. His favorites have left him and have been put to death. His uncle, the Duke of York, is abandoning him and is going over to Bolingbroke. And suddenly they've all deserted him. And instantaneously, this self-dramatist goes from being the center of the universe, protected by God and all of his heavenly court and the angels, to a complete, abject, helpless figure that is indeed simply down weeping at his own demise, and gives one of the greatest speeches Shakespeare ever penned. Daniel will know much of it. Old Merle says, where is the Duke, my father with his power? Where's the Duke of York? Richard, no matter where. Of comfort, no man's speed. Let's talk of graves, of worms, and epitaphs. Make dust our paper, and with rainy eyes write sorrow on the bosom of the earth. Let's choose executors and talk of wills, and yet not so. For what can we bequeath save our deposed bodies to the ground, our lands, our lives, and all our Bolingbrokes? And nothing can we call our own but death. And that small model of the barren earth which serves as paste and cover to our bones. For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, of some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court. And there the antic sits, scoffing his state and grinning at his pomp, allowing him a breath, a little seed, to monarchize, be feared, and kill with looks, infusing him with self and vain conceit, as if this flesh which walls about our life were brass impregnable, and humor thus comes at last, and with a little pin, bores through his castle wall, and farewell, king, cover your heads! And mock not flesh and blood with solemn reverence. Throw away respect, tradition, form, and ceremonious duty, for you have but mistook me all this while. I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends. Subjected thus, how can you say to me, I am a king? It's over the top, it's hyper-emotional, it's self-drunk. It's magnificent. It's magnificent. And you compare that to Bolingbroke coming and saying, I come up for my own. Now, the problem is, you wouldn't want either one of them to play. But one of them is the king. And Shakespeare is learning something here that will last him for the rest of his career. The mystery of the human personality and the complexity of the human soul expresses itself in language. Language is not only the way in which we get to know one another and can communicate. Language is also the key to discovering who we are. And it is not accidental that in this age of diminished human beings who deny their own souls, language is disappearing. I have students at the Naval Academy, good students, who would often walk down the hall and just grunt at each other. It's the reason why the vocabulary of the young has just been reduced. Have you read their text messages? Not only are they destroying language, but they have nothing to say. And now this new Twitter nonsense, where you only put 140 in and have little dots in, and what? No, give me Crazy Richard. Those words are magnificent. That is a living soul. As complex and crazy as all the rest of us, with a magnificent grasp of language, and also a truth. What does he discover in that speech? He too is human and is going to die, even though he's a king. Extraordinary. Now he's weeping over it, he's filled with self-pity, but we've all felt that at some point. Everybody's awakened at 2 a.m. and thought about the fact, I'm going to die. I'm wonderful. How could this happen? We've all done it. It has something to do with our sense of self and the importance of self, and it's an important moment of realization in terms of the loneliness of the self before death and eventually standing before God. There is much here in Richard that is coming to be interesting. I contrast Bolingbroke. Noble Lord, go to the rude ribs of that ancient castle, whose brazen trumpets send the breath of Parley into his ruined years, and thus deliver. Henry Bolingbroke on both his knees doth kiss King Richard's hand. It's not a drop of poetry in this man. He doesn't know who he is. All he is a politician. And indeed, Richard appears on the walls of the castle and becomes king again. Part of the fun with Richard is you never know who he's going to be the next time you see him. This personality is chameleon as well, constantly changing. Makes another grand, flourishing speech. By the way, there's a reason why the greatest Richard of the 20th century was Sir John Gielgud. With that magnificent voice and the ability to go into a moment fully and deeply, and Gielgud had the ability to weep on cue. I saw him interviewed once on a television program, and the interviewer said, "I understand that you can make yourself cry like that." And Gielgud said, "Well, I just have to think of certain things." And yeah. He said, "Can you do it now?" And Gielgud said, "Well, I suppose you can." I mean, there's a reason he was the greatest. Just that. A walking raw nerve. Walking hyper-emotion. Now, having confronted Bolingbroke, and then having Bolingbroke stand up to him and say, I get my own back, Richard launches into another one of his impassioned speeches that's a total flip-flop, but listen to this, and listen to what's coming to his mind now. And this is what I mean in that it is a soul beginning to grasp at things that it had no idea of before. Even as in his pride, he's beginning to fall. What must the king do now? Must he submit? The king shall do it. Must he be deposed? He's the first one to mention. Bolingbroke's not said. Must he be deposed? The king shall be contented. Must he lose the name of king of God's name? Let it go. I'll give my jewels for a set of beads, my gorgeous palace for a hermitage, my gay apparel for an almsman's gown, my figured goblets for a dish of wood, my scepter for a palmer's walking staff, my subjects for a pair of carved saints, and my large kingdom for a little grave, a little, little grave, an obscure grave. Core of truth there. Core of truth. Better to let it all go. It's self-display. It's not yet honest, but it's movement in the right direction. It's movement forward. Okay. Northumberland, who is at the right hand of Henry Bolingbroke, says, come down into the court, and Richard makes this grand dramatic moment, coming down from the top of the castle to the base court. I won't go through it again. And then simply says, I have to go to London now, don't I? Said on board's London, cousin, is it not so, Boyd? Yet he is giving the crown away. It is almost as if he's come to understand he doesn't deserve this. And if the country wants the practical politician, and if it becomes possible for him to show even more fully some of what's going on inside of him, then let's make it a big show, and let me give it away. You take it, I'm done with it. They go to London indeed, and the moment comes, it's Act 4, the deposition scene, which was never printed in Shakespeare's lifetime. This scene was so controversial that Richard II was popular. When it was printed in full, minus this scene, where Richard goes and hands over the crown to Henry Bolingbroke. There were real questions of succession in Elizabeth's time, as you will. It was very touching. In 1601, let's say 6 years after the play had been premiered, so it wasn't a popular favorite. It had its moment, it went. It wasn't one of those of enduring fame like Hamlet, for example. Popular, popular, popular. But nevertheless, people knew it. The Earl of Essex, 1601, Essex's Rebellion, he's marching into London, he's going to confront Elizabeth, and his followers come to London the day before and hire Shakespeare's company to put on a performance of Richard II, the day before Essex Rebellion. Well, now we know why they're doing that. And indeed, it included the deposition scene. And Elizabeth heard what had happened and said to one of her closest associates, know you not that I am Richard II? She knew very well why it had been put on and what the implications were. The Essex Rebellion failed, and Elizabeth had Shakespeare's company called in, and it was demanded of them, why did you put on that old play the day before Essex marched on London? And their response, the theater people that they were, well, because they paid us to do it. It was sufficient, and they all walked away going, got out of that story. The deposition scene, I'm not going to go through it, it is magnificent. but it includes in it something that has happened throughout this play. There has already been a moment earlier on where Richard has more or less been prophesying what's going to happen to you. He knows it's coming. Just before Richard enters in order to hand over the crown, the Bishop of Carlisle stands up and confronts the future Henry IV and makes a prophecy that no one has the right to take the crown away from the living king and just hand it on to someone else. Oh, for offended God that in a Christian climate souls refined should show so heinous lack of seen of being. I speak to subjects, and a subject speaks, stirred up by God thus boldly for his king. My Lord of Hereford here, that's Henry Bolingbroke, whom you call king, is a foul traitor to proud Hereford's king. And if you crown him, let me prophesy, the blood of English shall manure the ground, and future ages groan for this foul act. Peace shall go sleep with Turks and infidels, and in the seat of peace, tumultuous wars shall kin with kin, and kind with kind confound. Disorder, horror, fear, and mutiny shall here inhabit, and this land be called the field of Golgotha, and dead men's skulls. Oh, if you raise this house against this house, it will the woefulest vision prove that ever fell upon this cursing earth. Prevent, resist it, let it not be so, lest children, child's children, cry against you woe.
It's all true. The prophecy is fulfilled. What Henry Bolingbroke does is have the Bishop of Carlisle arrested and put to death on the spot. And indeed, in a very emotional scene, where he becomes the focus of the best theatrical moment he's ever had, hands the crown, takes the crown back, holds on to it. Okay, it's weeping, railing, it's magnificent stuff. But the most interesting moment comes when he wishes, he makes a public wish, and that is that he could simply disappear. He turns on the Earl of Northumberland, who says, "My lord, no lord of thine, thou haught, insulting man, nor no man's lord. I have no name, no title. No, not that name was given me at the font, but 'tis usurped. Alack the heavy day that I have worn so many winters out, and know not now what name to call myself." It's one of those admissions. He's been king, but he doesn't know who he is. "Oh, that I were a mockery king of snow, standing before the son of Bolingbroke, to melt myself away in water drops." And he begins to seek to be nothing. And it's not a wish for oblivion. It's a recognition of a complete lack of self-knowledge. It is, however, still rooted in his incredible narcissism and self-absorption. He calls for a mirror. And they bring the mirror to him, and he looks at his face in the mirror and addresses himself and then shatters it on the ground and begins picking up fragments of the broken mirror to look at himself in fragments. Quite literally, a broken man. But I would also say one of the first of modern men, in that modernism is about fragmentation. Taking that which God made whole and shattering it into pieces, and knowing this little piece and that little piece, and they don't connect, and not ever being able to put them back together again. And what Richard has realized is he does not know who he is, and he is a composite of tiny little pieces of a man that can only see little bits and pieces of himself as he looks in the mirror. This is the tragic self-knowledge he is gaining. And this accounts for much of his greatness, even as he is falling. So that, for all of his excesses, Shakespeare is creating sympathy for him. His queen is sent back to France. He himself is imprisoned. And there is a very strange scene where the Duke of York learns that his son is joining the opposition to the new king, and is going to go to the king to tell Henry, now Henry IV, to punish his own son, The mother finds out about it, and the whole family is rushing to Henry to see who can get there first and get the ear, king's ear first. What we have, it's almost a comic scene, but it's the acting out of what the Bishop of Carlisle prophesied, a house becoming divided against itself, a family ripped to pieces, that in the next play will erupt into civil war, England fighting against itself, a nation coming apart. I'm going to just look very quickly at the last scene in which Richard appears. He's in Pomfret Castle. That's where he's being held. He has a long soliloquy. It's brilliant. But it is, again, fragmentary. It's bits and pieces. It's a man trying to discover who he is, and the pieces don't always connect. Very good BBC film of this. It was done in the late 70s, starring Derek Jacobi as Richard II. John Gielgud is John of Gaunt, in fact. He's wonderful in it. But the director proves he's a good director because when he comes to Richard's great soliloquy at the end, he does it from different camera angles and breaks up the soliloquy into little parts. Almost Richard at different times, having different thoughts, and it's indeed what's going on in Richard's mind at that point. He is not coherent. He is not unified. He is not an integral man, but he's seeking. He's searching. He's thinking of biblical passages. He's trying to, as he says, I'll hammer it out. My brain, I'll prove the female to my soul, my soul the father. He's trying to beget a world of sensible thought, and he's not used to thinking. Thus play I in one person many people, Lee True. He has learned something about himself, and none contented. Sometimes am I king. Then treasons make me wish myself a beggar, and so I am. Then crushing penury persuades me I was better when a king. Then am I kinged again, and by think that I am unkinged by Bolingbroke, and straight am nothing. But whate'er I be, nor I, nor any man that but man is, with nothing shall be pleased till he be eased with being nothing. I'm nothing. And I will never have any ease or contentment in my life until I recognize that. This arrogant, proud man has, in private, not for show, assumed an ultimate sense of humility. I am nothing. I am. Music starts playing in the background, and it's out of rhythm. It says, keep time, keep time. When time is broke and no proportion kept, how sour sweet music is. And then he says another brilliant line, I wasted time, and now time wastes me. It's a line that everyone should think of as we grow older. All of those years when there was the possibility of doing real penance, adding graces to the slate, and what did we do? And then time wastes you until finally the end comes and there's no time. I wasted time, and now time wastes me. It's a magnificent soliloquy. An old groom of the stable comes and hails him as king. One last loyal subject, and at that moment, this happens over and over in Shakespeare, at that moment, Richard is now worthy to be a king. And the simple fact that there's one subject that acknowledges it is heartbreaking. And then in come the assassins, because Henry Bolingbroke, in his wisdom, has realized you don't want an old king hanging around when you've just been crowned, and there's a question about the crown. So he has sent Pierce of Exton and has said, Will no man rid me of this troublesome king? Pierce of Exton goes with two assassins. They break into the cell. And Richard confronts them. How now? What means death in this rude assault? He snatches a weapon and fights on behalf of himself in self-defense. This man of words, this man of self-dramatization, finally acts. There's some Hamlet here. And he fights against the assassins. He takes out two of them. before Pierce of Axton strikes him down, and he says to his assassin as he dies, "That hand shall burn in never-quenching fire that staggers thus my person. Axton, thy fierce hand hath with the king's blood stained the king's own land. Mount, mount, my soul, thy seat is up on high, whilst my gross flesh sinks downward, here to die." Axton goes back to King Henry with the body, says, "I did what you wanted me to do." And Henry says, "Oh, it's a terrible thing you've done. You shouldn't have done this." Axton says, "You ordered me to do it." And Henry says, "They love not poison that do poison need," and banishes him. And we're right back where we started, at the opening of the play. The historical cycle has moved on. We've got a new king confronting a terrible problem, and what does he do when he confronts it? Rather than deal with it, he banishes Pierce of Exton and says, "Now we have to pay tribute to Richard." And the play ends. But the series doesn't end, because we got three more plays to come. Thank you very much. I don't know if I should take questions now, or I know there's a question time tomorrow, but if you have questions about this or anything else, I'll be happy to take it. Or if you just want to hit the sandwiches, I recommend that too. If nothing else, well, then you can ask me in private, because I'm going to hit... Because he felt that Gloucester would not... Gloucester, having ruled, in a sense, for so long a time, was not about to give up power. There were factions that were being divided, and while John of Gaunt was smart enough to withdraw himself, Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, kept insisting on maintaining the power he had had when Richard was just a boy. And instead of dealing with it directly, he had him dismissed. He had him removed, I think is the best way to put it. Again, what you have is this whole sequence develops out of people who will not confront problems directly. They will not do it. They hem, they haw, they hedge, they banish, but they will not confront a problem and deal with it. And as a result, problems multiply. I'm sorry, I didn't hear. That's all right. I honestly don't remember. It's not in the play, and I don't remember. Yes. It's entirely possible. Insofar as he was wiping out opposition. Yes.
Would you say that Shakespeare had in mind new people when he was voicing his character? Or how did he...
It's hard to say. I would say almost any artist has to base his characters somehow on personalities he knows. They have to inspire him in some way. The remarkable thing about a really great creator is he can take this from this person, that from that person, and then add imaginative touches of his own and get something completely... We don't know for certain where many of the characters came from. I'll get into that in greater detail tomorrow when we get to talk about Sir John Falstaff, one of the greatest creations in all of literature. But we know it was to a tiny degree based on a historical figure, but much of it had to be based on Shakespeare's knowledge of other people or his own imagination. So I'd say composite, yeah. Mm-hmm. To the sandwiches.